Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley reporting to you from Washington, D.C. And it is the afternoon of Good Friday. Our greetings to those observing, marking Good Friday around the world. It is a very solemn day from that point of view. Here in Washington, D.C., though, we have the cherry blossoms blooming. The city is, in some ways, at its best. And therefore, we have to look at the international situation and then our domestic predicament, which we're working to solve. The Tax Wall Street Party covered itself with glory again this week. On Monday afternoon, we appeared at the AIPAC meeting with our signature sign, Trump equals Nazi. Once again, the Tax Wall Street Party set a standard of honesty, of morality, and of hard-hitting political work that everybody should copy. It should be all over the place. Trump equals Nazi. Forget about Trump as racist. That's all well and good. You can say that too. But worse than a racist is a Nazi. Believe me, because of course, if you're a Nazi, then you're including all kinds of racism as an integral part of that. And it means that you're going to enforce it with some pretty horrific means. So that dominated the entire scene. I think it dominated a lot of the news coverage. And of course, we have freakouts from longtime Trump supporters and newly acquired Trump supporters, those who have essentially capitulated to Trumpism, are upset about this. And we also detect a certain amount of tactical retreat by those Trumpists or Trumpeteers, as they may be called. So we'll talk about that, right? And what has to be done, how you deal with Trump, because we're acquiring a certain expertise. But anyway, the Tax Wall Street Party, once again, setting a standard for morality and courage and political analysis. And we're working now on an expose of those advisors that Trump named in his talk with the Washington Post editorial board this past Monday. And today we hope to get to Waleed Fares. Now, we have had another serious terrorist incident in Brussels, Belgium. Now, concerning this, rather than try to go through a whole forest of details, right, that you can pick up in other media, right? We read the wire services, right? Go to AP and Reuters and the rest of them, AFP. They'll tell you all that. But the thing is, obviously, there's a tremendous suspicion, because you look at our program last week. We were talking about what amounted to a cooperation between Putin and Obama to dump Erdogan of Turkey. Dump him. Get him out. Make sure that he's not allowed to gum up the works in the greater Middle East. And then, you know, 48 hours later, just a few, you know, a couple of days later, we then get this major terrorist incident in Brussels, Belgium. And then, in the middle of all that, Erdogan steps forward and says, oh, that guy who got killed blowing up airport there, the airport, one of the airport bombers, it turns out, Erdogan says that the Brussels airport bomber had been expelled by Turkey. Now, first of all, where's the proof of that? Let's see some proof on that, Erdogan. So then the question is, what did you do, Erdogan? Did you just let the guy go and put him on his own devices, let him fly out of Istanbul airport and go wherever he wanted to go? Did you notify NATO? Did you notify any governments? What did you do? Why didn't you hold him and ask some other NATO countries whether whether they had arrest warrants for this guy, if they knew more about him? Was he accused? Had he been indicted? Should he have been put on trial? And all this other stuff. As soon as you see Erdogan, watch out, right? Get a grip on your wallet, right? Get a grip, because Erdogan is the master of lies. So I'm looking forward. We hope to get a report from Syria today about the possible role of Erdogan. In other words, how does this all add up, that Erdogan comes forward after the fact, right? After being silent, and he comes and he says, oh, that key terrorist, we had him, but then we let him go, and therefore that's your fault. Wait a minute, Erdogan, that's your fault. You're not cooperating. You're not acting like a NATO member, right? Such as that is, right? You're acting like a snake. So we're watching Erdogan. Now, today, we have some good news for sure, which is that the Syrian Arab Army, for whom we have the greatest respect, has now captured the citadel, the fortress, the keep of the town of Palmyra, and they have ousted the butchers and killers of the Islamic State. That's something worth celebrating. Congratulate them on this essentially Good Friday victory. The other one we have is that Ashton Carter, not our favorite person, came forward today at the Pentagon this morning with the news that the United States forces, apparently special forces, had killed the finance minister of ISIS. Now, a couple of questions about this, right? They've killed somebody a few months ago that they also called the finance minister, but maybe this is the successor. Anyway, this is al-Kaduli. Al-Kaduli has been eliminated by the U.S. forces. According to some reports, the finance minister of al-Qaeda, according to some reports, the number two of al-Qaeda. I guess it's hard to judge that, but second only to al-Baghdadi. So are we justified in saying that this pincers, right, the Syrian Arab Army with Russian air support coming in from the West and the Kurds and select units of the U.S. Special Forces coming in from the East with U.S. air contributions also, that they are indeed chewing up ISIS? The headline today in the Washington Post is that you've got two things going on, right? Two parallel processes. ISIS makes gains in Europe, but faces setbacks in the Mideast. And on the latter side, extremists lose ground in Iraq and Syria. U.S. military officials say campaign has hit its stride. They're talking about 10,000 U.S. sorties now since last August, and a certain amount of decimation of the upper levels of al-Qaeda. All right, fine. Obviously, we're skeptical always. We want to verify. But it's important that they feel they have to talk about this, right? Because remember, under Allen, this was, you know, we were told that you had to wait 20 years for any replacements. That would be John Allen, the ousted ISIS czar. So this is going on. Now, Secretary of State Kerry has been to Moscow, 8 hours of meetings with President Putin and Foreign Minister Lavrov. We hope that this problem of the coordination of response to ceasefire violations, we hope that has been successfully cleared up. And we'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So again, watch Erdogan, right? If terrorism occurs and then Erdogan wants to butt his nose into it, you've got to be extremely suspicious. And it points to the idea that Erdogan may be flying some false flags as since he is in effect, right, the operative boss of ISIS, right? He is the caliph himself. But now, concerning the situation between the U.S. and Russia, the word is that these meetings have been much friendlier than they have been in the recent past. And I regard this as a confirmation of the policy that we've been putting forth here, the Tax Wall Street Party policy, which is that we want to go towards a condominium between the Russian Federation and the United States with a view to solving some of these intractable problems. And I think that's the idea. The news reports say that after these Kerry Putin and Kerry Lavrov meetings for 8 hours, there's a sense that you might be able to make the Syrian ceasefire permanent, since it seems to be holding up. And at the same time, of course, remember that ceasefire does not include attacking ISIS or attacking Al-Qaeda. They are, it's open season on them. They're in a fire-free zone wherever they are. But in terms of, I would say the main question, the repatriation of foreign fighters, in other words, kicking the foreign jihadis, the foreign fanatics, Islamists out of Syria, that's absolutely essential. So, ISIS is getting attrited. They've lost, what, 30, 40% of their territory. They seem to be able to fight back to some extent with these European terror attacks. I'm afraid we also have to say something about Belgium. Belgium is, to put it mildly, a very dubious country. First of all, any time you have a monarchy, and they do, Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, that's a monarchy and a half. You've got the idea that the monarchy and its minions, its hangers-on, the court, in other words, can intervene in police affairs, military affairs, secret intelligence affairs, and get all kinds of results. You've also got the fact that NATO intelligence is based there in Brussels and in Mons, right? M-O-N-S, NATO headquarters. Of course, factions of NATO intelligence, not all of it maybe, but certainly factions, are actively complicit in terrorism. They've been actively complicit in ISIS. And this is now complicated by the fact it's not just the U.S.-inspired complicities that we're talking about, but the British and the French, right, the Anglo-French with their treaty. Their idea that they act together on the world stage, this is now getting to be a more serious problem. In other words, you're going to have things where the British and the French are going to be stabbing the U.S. in the back. And that is very, very serious. And, of course, Turkey is also represented there. Who's the Turkish ambassador to NATO? I would take a look at that. What's with the Turkish consulates on a bilateral framework, not NATO, but Turkish consulates? I'd like to know what they're doing in Belgium these days. I would begin to look at them. But the idea is that Belgium, once again, very, very dubious country. My experience in Brussels is that there seem to be organized crime, especially pickpockets, frankly, in the Brussels subway. This experience almost a decade ago. But you'd find these pickpockets, and they'd be there all the time. You'd go through certain subway stops in the Brussels subway, and there'd be known pickpockets, right? Guys who tried to pick your pocket would be standing there and trying to pick off tourists or whatever it was. So you got the idea that somehow the monarchy, NATO headquarters, and those pickpockets had something to do with one another. The other question, of course, was the child murders, the questions of pedophilia on the part of the ruling class between NATO and Belgium. You can look all that up. Supermarket killings, all kinds of things. So it's a very, very strange legal environment to be in. So they're now getting their share of attention, and that's probably a good idea because they needed to get it. I noticed also that the Belgian interior minister offered his resignation But that resignation was rejected. No, 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 no. Hey, Eurogarchs, Eurogarchs, Eurocrats. Ministerial responsibility is if you're the interior minister, the police minister, when something like those Belgian attacks take place, you've got to resign. You've got to move yourself out of there. Because otherwise, how can there be public confidence in government? It's impossible. There's also the question of the agitation of the Flemings and the Walloons, the French-speaking Walloons and the Nederlands, right? Dutch-speaking Flemings. And this has also opened up terrible potentials for Secret Service, Secret Intelligence Agency activity. So that's also we're not going to delve into the causes of that, just to say that it is fomented by intelligence agencies, and they are undoubtedly having a field day inside those police forces, right? Since they're small, it's a small country, and then there's some kind of rivalry going on between the Walloons and the Flemings. All of this makes for a terrible situation. So Europeans, Eurogarchs, Eurocrats, you better clean up your act, because if that's going to be your capital there in Brussels, you cannot have a situation of lawlessness like that. And that Belgian monarchy, frankly, gives me the creeps. So there we go. And by the way, I've had experience in the past. If you go out on the street and try to criticize them, they try to get you for lèse-majesté, L-E-S-E. There's a little accent grave over the first E. Majesté, M-A-G-E-S-T-E, aigu on the E. And that's important for us here because that's what Trump wants. Trump undoubtedly wants a law of lèse-majesté, where you're not allowed to criticize the fascistissimo Donald Trump. So you better get out there and fight about that. All right. So this is at least an overview. We will supplement this later in the broadcast. Now, we're very proud, as I said, of the Tax Wall Street Party intervention against Trump. It didn't take a lot of money. It didn't take a lot of people. It just takes political will and courage and intelligence and some good graphic arts. And we urge everybody to do the same thing. Every place that guy goes, he should have to see something like that poster that we put up. And we'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpon here in Washington, D.C. with the cherry blossoms on Good Friday in the afternoon, right? It is the 25th of March. So, good, vigorous demo against Trump in the middle of Washington, D.C. And as a part of this, there has been a backlash, an attempt to answer this intervention on the part of certain libertarian forces. So this moves us to call everybody's attention to what we hope is an interesting essay in today's morning briefing, the daily briefing of today. You can find this at tarpley.net. You should please go to tarpley.net every day. There is something new up there just about every day, almost every day. And this time it's this question of the libertarian political movement or political libertarianism, and how that movement is now dying, and Trump is indeed the gravedigger of it. And the idea is that in the recent past, I've seen various publications where they say, well, libertarianism is the opposite of fascism. It's the opposite of the Trump version of fascism. And I'm afraid that is absolutely untrue. And indeed, it's much more like the idea of a continuum or a conveyor belt where the libertarian doctrines, if they're enacted and if they spread in a society, they help to break down civilization. And because libertarianism is an attack on civilization. And if you allow this to grow and get into different parts of your society, you're going to find that your political institutions are going to be destroyed, and your economic institutions are going to be destroyed. So it's libertarianism as a conveyor belt, as the entranceway, the open door that it goes through. And the examples of this are many. One, 1920, this is a little bit retrospective, but you get the idea. The libertarians saying the crash of 1920 was a wonderful thing because it was allowed to burn itself out. Notice that one of the doctrines, as I show in this little essay, one of the doctrines of libertarianism is this Austrian school mumbo-jumbo that you're not allowed to fight a depression. Once the depression begins, you should try to make it worse. You should try to emphasize it, right? Radicalize the depression. We once had Peter Schiff go on the radio during his ill-starred Senate campaign in Connecticut and say, you know what we need? We need more unemployment, more unemployment. What does that mean? Oh, it means so we can drive down wages and bankrupt a lot of people and make assets cheaper. And obviously what you can see is if you have any brains at all, that the libertarian is somebody who has money. He thinks that even after a panic crash, he'll still have money. He's got it, you know, in safes and in, you know, abroad and all kinds of places. And they're going to buy everything up and they're going to buy you up. That's the point. They're going to drive down wages and they're going to buy you at bargain basement prices. So that's the 1920 example, as they say, wasn't that great? It was so short. It was so swift. It was all over in a little while. The problem is out of that 1920 crash at the end of World War One came what? Mussolini's March on Rome in October 1922. The direct relation is, you know, practically obvious causality. It is at least a factor, right? There were specific Italian factors as well, but you get the idea. That's what was happening. So the wonderful crash of 1920. Then we have Brüning. During the 1920s, the London School of Economics and a very ugly oligarch called Sir Lionel Robbins became sponsors of this Austrian school, and they called it the psychological school. And why is this? Normally, economics has to be concerned with great objective quantities, right? What's your steel production? What's your standard of living? How many tons of grain? You know, what's the average wage? How many years of education do people get? What's the situation with your public health system and all that? Austrian school says, forget all that, forget all that. All the Austrian school wants to know about is the wretched internal psychology of a speculator, a parasite, somebody who's out to rip people off, producing nothing, speculating and trying to get in there and make a killing, right? That's the theoretical vantage point. Now, there are other theoretical vantage points. Keynesianism proceeds from the theoretical vantage point of a central banker. Some others, you know, proceed from the standpoint of a company that might even be producing something. That's a little bit better. But the worst of all, absolute, the lowest of the low, is this idea of the libertarians that it's just, you know, it's the psychological motivation, the marginal tendencies of the individual ripoff artist, right? Speculator, predator. Notice where it comes from. The American school, the American system, so successful in the U.S. after the American Civil War, had impressed Bismarck of Germany. He wanted to introduce key parts of it into Germany to industrialize the country. He did that in part. Russia was also very interested. We've gone through the story of Cassius Clay, Lincoln's ambassador to Russia. But then the Austrians, in this case the Habsburgs, right, the rivals of Prussia, they saw that it was this thing called the Prussian or Historical School of Economics. And there was also somebody like Friedrich List, right? Friedrich List was the customs union that allowed Germany to become united to a significant degree, at least parts of it. And Friedrich List also built a lot of railroads in Central Europe. And he was a theoretician, and he lived in Pennsylvania for a good part of his life. So he was an American citizen also. He was not a prophet in his own country, unfortunately, right? The free marketeers have essentially covered up a lot of his contributions. But the Austrians responded to that, says, let's get Ernst Mach, the crazy, radical, subjectivist theoretician of science, and let's mix that together with Karl Menger, and we're going to call that the Austrian school, and we're going to try to fight the German historical school and the German school of protectionism. So what you're, if you're professing Austrianism, you're essentially embracing a toxic foreign doctrine from one of the countries in Europe at that time, the Habsburg Empire, that was, let's say, least dynamic industrially, economically. So it's something that was thought up in Vienna to try to prevent the spread of the German historical school into Austria and try to sabotage it inside Germany as well. And you're going to be an American and embrace that? It's silly. By the way, the Austrians of today, whom we hold in high regard, obviously, these are people who don't have time for the Austrian school. If you're naively coming off listening to libertarian radio, and then you get to Vienna and you say, okay, where's the Austrian school? Well, it's not there because they don't want it, right? They have no time for it, right? There's scant interest in today's Vienna for the Austrian school. So this is part of the prelude. Now, what we were getting to with that was Heinrich Brüning of Germany, the chancellor from the spring of 1930 to the summer of 1932, carried out the most unbelievable, the most amazing, as others would say, austerity program. And it was absolute bone-crushing, killer austerity in Germany. What did he do? He destroyed the economic system. The unemployment rate went so high, this opened the door to Hitler's seizure of power. So in this case, the application of Austrian school doctrines, which Brüning seems to have gotten from Lionel Robbins during his time at the London School of Economics, leads directly into the tragedy of National Socialism in Germany. And the other one is what we're seeing today, how you go from being a libertarian to being an exponent of Trumpery. Back in a minute. What was going on there in 1920 when the failure to fight that depression worldwide opened the door to Mussolini's march on Rome and the institution of a fascist government, right? Probably the first one, although there are some competitors. And then this question of how Brüning's austerity opened the door to Hitler. What about today? Well, we're seeing unbelievably, right? People that have been talking for a decade or more, maybe even two decades, about limited government, individual liberties. They're objecting to surveillance. They don't like the police state, right? Neither do we. But now they've gone from that, you know, and they've started, unfortunately, with what I must call an absolutely imbecilic reading of the Constitution. In other words, it's the Jefferson imbecilic reading of the Constitution that a lot of libertarians have started with, right? It's essentially a non-existent, pathetically weak federal government. But now what they've done is they've shown you that they didn't really believe all of that. None of that meant anything to them. They're trampling the Constitution because they're rushing to lick the boots of Trump. And look at that. Isn't that a spectacle to see? That's what's happening. Now, couple of other things. In terms of Ron Paul, right, because the libertarians, as you can see, right, from about, I would say from about 2001 or 2002, maybe 2003, up until about 2008, the libertarians had something positive to offer, and that was that because of these circumstances, right, almost structurally, they had to be against George W. Bush. They had to be against Cheney. They had to be against the wars. And they had to be interested in 9/11 truth, at least a lot of them. But the problem was then after 2007, 2008, it began to become the dynasty of the Pauls, right? The Paul dynasty. First Ron Paul and then little Rand Paul. And that gets you from about 2008 until 2014, 15 really, when it was clear that little Rand was going nowhere because Trump had stolen his racket, right? This pose of the outsider, the anti-establishment figure. This is baloney. This is absolute garbage. be it applied to the Paul dynasty, be it applied to Trump. They're all insiders. It's clear. You're going to be a billionaire in Manhattan and be an outsider? Come on. Come on. And have all these buildings. It's absolutely out of the question. But here's the problem. As soon as this 9/11 question dissipated, because once you have Obama in power, the government is no longer really based on the 9/11 story told. And as soon as you shift over to supporting Ron Paul, especially Ron Paul in 2012, you have become intellectually and morally bankrupt. And that's what they're paying for. The libertarians are paying and the Republicans are paying too, because this went into the creation of Donald Trump. Trump says, let's deport 12 million people. That's a police state, right? That's cattle cars, box cars. I'm sorry. That's holding pens, steel cages on every street corner, screaming women and children in the night. I'm sorry. That's what it's going to lead to. Don't kid yourself. But here's the problem. What has been the effect of Ron Paul in particular on the political culture of the United States? Well, in my distinguished book, Just Too Weird, Bishop Romney and the Mormon Takeover of America with Polygamy, Theocracy, and Subversion, if you look on page 233, we discuss this budget, which Ron Paul put out, the Restore America budget, calls for genocidal austerity on two counts. First, Paul proposed to cut 63% from the food stamp allowance of 50 million Americans whose lives were at risk. This would have killed and would kill many, many Americans by doing this. Right? So how many hundreds of thousands, how many millions of Americans must lose their lives for the greater glory of the crackpot Austrian school? Here we see the real function of the Ron Paul campaign. In the 1940s and 1950s, proposals like the one advanced by Ron Paul might have gotten their bearer a one-way ticket to a mental hospital, right? Bellevue, Pilgrim State, St. Anne's, whatever, the loony bin, a canvas blazer, and a padded cell. But if people had taken these proposals seriously, the response could well have been, Nazi, go home. But now, thanks to Ron Paul and others, proposals for genocide against the American people had somehow become presentable, respectable, and acceptable, at least in the Republican Party, as the basis for polite discussion. Ron Paul had earned his pay. He had spewed ideological poison to such an extent that there was a massive moral and intellectual degradation of the American people, starting with the Republicans, to the point where a Republican audience would seriously entertain demands for the mass death of fellow Americans. Now, that's what Trump is building on. Trump comes out and says, I'm gonna deport 12 million people, right? Your neighbors, your coworkers, right? Obscene. And I'm gonna have a Islamophobia as one of the principles of my regime. Well, this is just awful, but you can see where it came from. If you're willing to go along with the cruelty and this absolute, what can I say? It's immorality of what Paul was talking about with his Restore America budget. You can still find this online. It came out in October 2011. The other thing that Ron Paul wanted to do was to cut off all U.S. emergency food aid. Well, the good old USA still provides about 60% of the emergency food aid in the world. So you take away that 60%, you tell me how many millions will die. And that's something that Ron Paul stood behind. So when you have a party that's going to tolerate that kind of stuff, then you are in big trouble because you have crossed into the land. Well, if you insist on violating natural law like that, right? If you insist on attacking the very existence of so many human beings, well, there's nemesis waiting for you. There are the Furies waiting for you. Violators of natural law tend to go down. They tend to have a bad end. So it's time to turn away from all of that. So the other interesting thing that's going on, the Mormons, right? We're interested in the Mormons. Now, the Mormons are following Cruz. This is actually interesting. Remember, when evil fights evil, the good can benefit. The Mormons with Cruz are fighting Trump. And this means Glenn Beck, big supporter of Cruz. It means you look at the Wyoming caucus, I guess, Republicans, Idaho Republican caucus, and now this past week, the Utah Republican caucus. In Utah, Cruz got more than half of the votes, got all the delegates. Trump got 15% in the Mormon Mecca of Utah. So what does this show? Big problem for libertarians, right, who have been flirting with the Mormons quite a bit. Now, what do they find? If you go with Trump, you're going to get a backlash from your own audience because people remember and say, wait a minute, surveillance, police state, a dictator, a man on horseback, an authoritarian, a totalitarian. We don't want that. That's Trump. The other side, if you go with Trump, what you're going to find is that the Mormons that have been, you know, a part of your support will no longer be there. Now, some things about Trump. The first thing, and we may have to postpone this until after our Syrian report, but here's the idea. From a purely cynical, practical, political point of view, this week would have been the week for Trump to try to step forward and say, I am the protector. I am a strong man. I offer you security. I'll protect you. After Brussels, that's what it should have been. And instead, Trump has stupidly committed absolutely idiotic blunder, which is instead of being presidential and the great protector against terrorism, he comes out attacking the other guy's wife and is now rolling in the mud of mutual insults to the spouses. So this is the vulnerability of Trump, and we will expose it later. Yes. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome to the second hour of World Crisis Radio. It is once again the afternoon of Friday, the 25th of March, and the cherry blossoms are here in Washington. But as I was saying at the beginning of the broadcast, the bombs, the attacks in Brussels coming after the Paris attacks of last November. And now in the middle of this, we get Erdogan of Turkey coming forward, this very sinister figure. What is he doing? Why does anybody believe what he says is the first question. But in order to get this cleared up, we wanted to go to an excellent source, an unimpeachable source on these matters. And that is our friend Thierry Maison, who is in Damascus, Syria, we believe. And I think he can enlighten about it. So, Thierry, please tell us about the connection of Erdogan to these terrible terrorist attacks.
Yes, to understand what happened first in Paris in last November and this week in Brussels, you have to know all the tricks between Turkey, the European Union, and France about the Kurdish question. You have to know that at the beginning of 2011, the French Minister of Foreign Affairs, Alain Juppé, make a secret agreement with his Turkish counterpart, Ahmet Davutoglu. According to this document, I haven't seen it, but I know a diplomat who studied very carefully this document. According to him, France and Turkey precise the condition of the war in Libya and in Syria. But France take the engagement to create a new state. It's not precisely said in the document, but it could be in Syria and in Iraq, or in Syria only, it's not clear. But to create a new state, they will call it Kurdistan. They will put a Kurdish man as the head of the state. And after that, Turkey will expel all the Turkish people from his country to this new one. So the Turkish people could be alone in Turkey.
So ethnic cleansing, the ethnic cleansing of the Anatolian
Peninsula. Absolutely. Ethnic cleansing. Yes. So, later, when the war started in Syria, President François Hollande, it was at the end of 2014, organized a secret meeting with President Erdogan, and Erdogan was officially in Paris, but a third people was in this meeting, and this is secret, and it was Saleh Muslim, which is one of the two heads of the Kurdish party in Syria. So, and that guy betrayed the Kurds from Turkey and, you know, the PKK from Abdullah Öcalan. And he decided to support the French and Turkish project. Of course, he said he will be the head of the new state, and he will host all the Kurds from Turkey. At that time, Turkey was sure to obtain this arrangement because Syria was in a very bad condition during that part of the war. But just after that, it was the Battle of Kobane. And you remember this small town, a Kurdish town at the border of a Turkish state.
Right.
And during this Battle of Kobane, the Kurdish people win against Daesh, against the ISIS. So it was a big shock for everybody. And you know that the U.S. decides that if they want to really fight against Daesh, they need to support the Kurdish people because they are the only one to have the victory against them. And of course, France followed the movement, and President François Hollande decided to change his policy, and he received officially this time at the Elysee Palace a delegation from the Kurdish people of Syria, without Saleh Muslim, but with two other people. So, of course, it was a big disappointment for Turkey. And that's just at this moment that occurred the big attacks in Paris in the 3rd of November. So, of course, it could be that the first this attack in Paris was the answer of Turkey for the flip-flop from France. So, but the story continues because you know that the Russian enter in Syria, they make a big bombing against Daesh, and when they withdrew, President Erdogan was thinking it was time again to create this fake Kurdistan to expel its people in this new state. But the relation between Turkey and Russia was very, very bad. You remember, you have a lot of problems between them. First, Turkey is suspected to be responsible for the destruction of a Russian plane in the Sinai in Egypt. After that, it's sure that they destroy a Sukhoi, a Russian plane, military plane in Syria. You know that President Putin accused Erdogan to be responsible of the traffic of oil with Daesh and so on, so it was very bad relations. So, but when the Russian withdrew, it was a good occasion for Turkey to restart this project, except that Russia and the United States have an agreement together against Turkey. They agreed to oust Erdogan, And for that purpose, they began to send weapons to the YPG, the Kurds in Syria, and from the Kurds in Syria, they sent, in fact, this weapon to the PKK, the Kurds in Turkey. So President Erdogan tried to convince the European Union to help him. You know that the European Union gave him 3 billion euro each year, officially, to help him to host the migrants, but in fact, this money is to continue the war. There is no way to verify how we will use this money. And of course, it's because it's for war. President Erdogan, the 18th March, made a very big speech for the anniversary of the Gallipoli battle during the First World War.
Jerry, hold that thought. Hang on, hold that thought. We've got one of these automatic station breaks coming up, but we want to get you back to finish the story. And we will be back in just a second here on World Crisis Radio. Don't miss the rest. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Now, we're talking with Jerry Maison in Damascus. The audience of this program, you know, based on last week's broadcast, that there is this understanding between Obama and Putin that Erdogan has to go. He must be removed, and these flows of weapons from Russia and from the United States going to the YPG Kurds in northern Syria and the PKK Kurds in southeast Turkey, also in Iraq. So just at the moment where Erdogan is in that bind, we then get the Brussels terror attack. So, Thierry, please continue.
So, the 18th March, it was the anniversary of the Battle of Gallipoli during the First World War, and President Erdogan made a very important speech broadcast on the TV, and during that speech, he explained that the European Union, and especially Belgium, was supporting the PKK. And he said that because of that, Belgium and the European Union are terrorist organizations. He said also that Belgium must be prepared to have bombing in Brussels, exactly like there is now bombing in attacks in Ankara and Istanbul. And he continues saying that Belgium is hosting the PKK, it's like hosting a snake in his own bed. So, 4 days later, there was this big attack in Belgium, especially in Brussels. Of course, you can think this is only coincidence. You can think that President Erdogan was speaking hardly, not thinking to what will happen for the later. But it's not possible. Because the day after the attack in Brussels, all the Erdogan press in Turkey making a big title underlying how it was just and good to punish Belgium with its attacks. So it is very clear that the government of Turkey was reclaiming his own responsibility in this attack in Brussels.
Very striking.
Yes, it's astonishing to see. But right now, the members of the European Union are really not understanding what is happening with Turkey, because they don't understand what is really Turkey, what is the ideology of Erdogan. You know that Erdogan is coming from the Miligorush. Miligorush is an Islamic movement, especially for Turkey, but linked with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and also linked with the Hizbut Tahrir. All these three organizations are supporting the idea to create a new caliphate. And of course, this was done by Daesh with the help of Erdogan. Right. And these three organizations are promoting a vision of Islam which is very narrow and intolerant Islam.
Jerry, concerning these groups now, some of these are a little bit less known here, right? The Miligorush is the first one. Can you repeat the third one also, in addition to the Muslim Brotherhood?
Miligorush is the Turkish one. It was created by Mr. Erbakan, who died 4 years ago. But it was created in 79, something like that. The Muslim Brotherhood is something much more older. It was created in 1928 by the British and by Hassan el-Banna, who was a Jewish guy converted to Islam. And you have a third group, which is a kind of section from the Muslim Brotherhood, which is called Hizbut Tahrir, and which is especially developing in Central Asia. So the three groups are working together with the same ideology. And all the leaders of all the jihadist groups in the world, all of them are coming from the Muslim Brotherhood, in fact, or Miligorush. All of them. You know, for instance, Osama bin Laden was a disciple of Sayyid Qutb, one of the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood. And Ayman al-Zawahiri was one of the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. But you can have exactly the same remarks with all the leaders of the jihadist groups. But something very specific with Miligorush is that they are not only Islamic people, they are also Turkish nationalists. And according to them, the real Turkish people is a special race, a superior race. And they have to govern all the world and to impose Islam to all the world. And President Erdogan himself said that the real Turkish people are the descendants from the Huns, from Attila. Yes, he said that. And he received now all the foreign leaders in his new White Palace, a very big palace, the biggest head of state palace in the world. And when he receives them, he has always 16 warriors with all the old dresses, so that you can see the 16 old empire coming from the Mughals and from the Huns. And he said he's not a neo-Ottoman. He said he will create a 17th empire. And as he's comparing himself to Attila or to Genghis Khan, you have to understand that man is a real danger for everybody in the world.
Absolutely. He sounds absolutely crazy. Jerry, thank you so much. We'll be looking for you in the very near future, as next week if possible. Thank you very much.
Okay. Goodbye.
See you soon. That's Thierry Maison, and a tremendous source of Middle East intelligence, and we're going to be looking up that Erdogan speech. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So take a look at Tarpley.net when you hear this broadcast. We will try to track down that speech where President Erdogan of Turkey, right, the madman, the exponent of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan, but now we've also got these other groups, that these other networks that he's got, right? This is now, this sounds like, well, a loony bin, to be sure, crazy, but unfortunately also head of state. So this is a very big deal. Now, we got to switch back to domestic, and that is what happened this week with Trump. And again, I think this indicates the tremendous vulnerability of Trump. After those Brussels bombs, right here in the land of the benighted, Trump's obvious card would have been to posture and present himself as the tough guy, the man on horseback who's going to smash those terrorists, and rant and rave about that. Right? And he did. He gave a speech at the AIPAC, which was mainly wrapped up with, I want to liquidate NATO. From his demagogic point of view, this was really dumb, because that was the wrong thing. He was supposed to say, I'll protect Europe, I'll protect everybody, I'm going to restore the greatness of the U.S., right? Make America great again. He didn't do any of that. Somebody very clever at that pro-Cruz super PAC, I think it's a charming lady, who decided to go and dig up these risque pictures of Melania Trump, right? Melania Knaus Trump, or Knaps, from Slovenia, but also then Germanicized. Melania Trump, of course, photo model, supermodel, whatever, and lots of risque photos. So they trotted this out for the Utah primary, right? This is going to be your first lady unless you vote for Cruz. Since this was the Utah primary, I also suspect the hand of the Latter-day Saints, right, of the Danites, I think it is, the political intelligence group of the Mormons, maybe they decided to show what they could do vis-a-vis Trump. And they've set a very interesting example. The point being, if you jab at Trump, you can manipulate him because he is pre-programmed to strike back. It's like a Pavlovian reflex, right? It's like hitting the knee and then the knee jumps up, right? You got the idea. Pavlovian response. You ring the bell, he salivates. In this case, you attack something that he cares about, you denigrate him, and then he has to fight back. So what happened then was, instead of being able to profile himself as the great statesman and anti-terrorist fighter who's going to pacify the world, Trump is now rolling in the mud, right? Threatening the other guy's wife. Watch out or I'll spill the beans on Heidi. Well, we know about Heidi. Heidi is Goldman Sachs, right? There's all kinds of stuff there. And then putting out these comparative pictures of Heidi and Melania, right? This is absolutely boorish, stupid, infantile, barbaric, primitive, right? But that's what he did. Now here's, I think we can generalize out of this, right? We saw that you can get his goat. And the way you get his goat, there are a couple of articles online about how you run against Trump, right? This is one from Salon, right? So, but, you know, gold is where you find it, especially these days. Understand what Trump is and expose it. Trump is a child. He's narcissistic, insecure, and petulant. These are very bad traits for a president. And if you don't force Trump to come out in the open in this way, you have failed. In order to draw out Trump's inner child, you have to poke it. You have to injure his pride. When he feels wronged or threatened, he can't control himself. He hits back and he gets personal, and it's absolutely, again, primitive, all those things. He hurls insults, right? You're a loser. You're a choke artist. You're Lion Ted. You're Little Marco. He tells his rivals they should get off the stage because they're low in the polls. His outbursts are unbelievably puerile. This behavior is going to offend a lot of independents and a lot of Republicans. He lashes out at candidates, his opponents, but also media figures, right? Megyn Kelly, Hugh Hewitt. And, of course, from our point of view, right, from the point of view of the philosophy of history, let's say, the Tax Wall Street Party, we want this fighting to increase. So what we've seen this week is a great example. You put some kind of attention on his wife that he doesn't like, and you will find him going bonkers, quite obviously. Now, I would say it would be important to focus on who can you attack? How about attacking Trump's grandfather, right? The guy who ran brothels, whorehouses in the Yukon during the Alaska Gold Rush. Original Drumpf, Herr Drumpf up there, right? That's his grandfather. Then his father, apparently arrested at a KKK meeting, Ku Klux Klan in Queens, New York. Find a way to attack Trump's sister, if you can. She's apparently a federal appeals court judge, right? Get something about her. We have the first wife, Ivana. She has moved off the stage. In the case of Ivana, you might be better off getting Ivana to come forward with some spicy revelations. Now we have Melania. We have the daughter, Ivanka, who he talks about. He brings her out on the stage. As soon as these people come out on the stage, brought out there with Trump for campaign events, I'm sorry, they then get into the range of public figures. If you don't want to do that, then they should stay home. But they haven't done that. It's too late. His two sons, my God, Trump's sons, have gone berserk, killing wild animals on big game safaris in Africa. There was a big flare-up of hatred against them. So the idea is, we're not suggesting that these are important election issues. These are the issues needed to make Trump go bonkers. This is the point. So, infantile, megalomaniac, he's narcissistic, he's all of this, right? Play onto that weakness, jab him, poke him, needle him. His bragging covers his insecurity. My guess is that he was not loved as a child. In other words, there's something, and that stint at military school probably goes in that direction. In other words, he's got some kind of a tremendous shame, some kind of a tremendous guilt, or some kind of a feeling inside of himself that he does not merit love. Notice he's always got to get in the last word, right? One of these interesting articles says, if you raise a topic that's bad for Trump, he will insist on talking about it and not stopping. Trump latches on to negative themes about himself. He has to get the last word. He has to get the last 200 words. Goes on for minutes explaining sordid details that viewers have not heard. You think he'd just, you know, say no comment. But no, he says, I've won most of those lawsuits. So he's got to talk about these things. Needle him. Mexico will not pay for the wall. Atlantic City. This is really important. Atlantic City is now on the brink of collapse. Atlantic City is bankrupt. There's no money to pay the police, the fire department, the teachers, the public employees. We should needle Trump on Atlantic City. This is actually the best of these issues, right? Not just the people in his family and trying to get a rise out of him on those. But Atlantic City, we'll be back in a minute. After Trump looted Atlantic City, he squeezed it like a lemon, threw it on the garbage heap. That place is collapsing. Hold Trump accountable. Get him on Atlantic City. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Got to rush forward to make sure we do justice to some of these important themes. We're going to go into a situation now where for about 2 weeks, the primary action goes into a lull. It looks something like this. 2 weeks now, call it the Easter break, whatever. Very few primaries, caucuses, almost nothing, as a matter of fact. After 2 weeks, you get the Wisconsin primary. That's going to be important, right? That's a place where Trump could be stopped. That's a place where Bernie Sanders could get somewhere. So we got 2 weeks with basically nothing. Then the Wisconsin primary. Then 2 more weeks, and then New York State. Okay, that's pretty much it. So for the next month, We got the Wisconsin after 2 weeks, and then after 4 weeks from now, approximately the New York state primary. But now, Trump, Mr. Atlantic City, right? Mr. You know, not maybe Mr. Las Vegas, although he's that too, but perhaps even closer to home for him, that Trump is the spirit of Atlantic City. Okay, Atlantic City hurtled on Thursday, yesterday, as we're speaking, towards a financial crisis that means payments in IOU, scrip, for police officers, funny money, community currency, for police officers, firefighters, and sanitation workers, while city and state officials trade blame for the seaside gambling resort's increasingly dire predicament. So Trump is out there boasting. I can see the ad already. He said, ha-ha, I got out of Atlantic City just in time. I dumped all that debt on the city. Right now, the mayor, Don Guardian, that's his name, Guardian. So Mayor Guardian of Atlantic City says there's going to be a shutdown starting April 8th. And by May 2nd, the shutdown will become, perhaps complete. On April 8th, we will run out of money, and that's a fact. The situation has to be resolved with help of the state of New Jersey. We'll get to that. The state of New Jersey has seen Atlantic City has seen the largest source of tax income, the gambling casinos, and that's not an industry, by the way, crumble in recent years. The city can't last long. Christie, and then of course, the stooge of Trump is, of course, Governor Christie of New Jersey, right? Cutting that sorry figure, right? Really reducing himself to wretched status. Christie says, oh, you guys in Atlantic City created your own problems by overspending. Overspending, Chris? How about your buddy Trump? Did he do anything about that? So there could be then a take, the state may take over the finances of Atlantic City. There's also an attempt to get casinos to make payments in lieu of property taxes, right, to get some money coming in. This is obviously a mess. So the hypocrite Christie trying to protect his corrupt friend Trump. I would get some camera teams down to Atlantic City. I'd interview some people who had worked in Trump casinos. I bet they have some choice tales to tell. And now what's going to happen to them now? And this is simply, it's just awful, right? Why, is Christie blocking bipartisan legislation to try to deal with this? And of course, we would have to say Trump's bankruptcies, right? Trump has personally, as far as I can understand, Trump never went through personal bankruptcy, but he's got at least four bankruptcies of his wholly controlled entities, right? The various hotel and resort and other companies. And as a result of this, he has dumped a lot of the suffering on merchants and subcontractors and suppliers and all the rest of this stuff. He has played fast and loose with a million small businessmen as he went bankrupt. So Trump, you're a loser. The other thing I would like to point out, again, gold is where you find it. Somebody needed to call Trump a coward because that's obviously what he is. So that turned out to be Cruz. Now, of course, Cruz, clerical fascist, we don't like it. But there's, again, a sense of historical justice. Right? You've got to call him a fascist. You should call him a Nazi. And at the same time, a coward, as in scratch a bully, you'll find a coward. I think that's the secret of Trump. So needle him. We should also be aware that Trump remains a weak candidate. And again, I'm always going to be running scared through this season because the Hillary people, let's just mention that. The Hillary campaign says, oh, no, they're not going to get down there and roll in the mud. Clinton, this is Washington Post, Monday, March 21st. Clinton preps for Trump matchup. Goal is to paint him as unfit for office. Researchers are mining his dealings and remarks. The problem is, it's fine for the presidential candidate to take the high road. I think that there's a certain logic to that. But you better have an attack dog vice presidential candidate if you're going to get anywhere, oh, Hillary people. And you can see her impotence. This is essentially a school marm approach by Hillary. Neither the Clinton campaign nor several independent super PACs working on her behalf plan to respond with the same brass knuckle style that Trump has taken with his Republican opponents. But Trump is also not Teflon. This is pathetic. This is useless. This is why this woman shouldn't be there. Maybe she will be indicted. Maybe she will be jailed by the end of it. That would be the best outcome. Maybe Bernie can pull himself together. Who knows, right? Our advice, of course, remains the same. Hold your nose and vote for Bernie and stop Trump. And if you hold your nose and vote for Bernie, it will have stopped Hillary, too. That's our outlook on this stuff. But with that kind of school mom stuff, you'd think that somebody would be out there delving into Trump. It's obviously not going to be anything controlled by Hillary Clinton. So the potential for the Democratic Party to put Trump in the White House is considerable. However, as of March 23rd, this past Tuesday in the various Arizona and other caucuses, we've got Trump coming in well below 50% at this late date. Trump got 39% of the vote on Tuesday, March 22nd. A lot of this is the $2 billion of free media hype that he has received. He has never gotten over 50% in any state. Trump only gets pluralities. He has never gotten an absolute majority. As of the day after the Arizona primary, Trump got about 40%, less than 40%. He got 39% of the vote in the places and caucuses and primaries of last week. So the idea is we've had 31 states that have voted. We're, again, sort of three-fifths more or less through it, right? Because there were states, territories, and possessions. It's more than 50. Cruz has gotten a majority in two states, Utah and Wyoming, right? This is the Mormon base turning out. So Trump gets, up to now, 37% of the nationwide vote in the Republican primaries and caucuses. But you can see that is not a formidable candidate. How can a minority go to the convention and say, we demand that the majority yield to us? Because he's got more people against him than he's got for him. Couple interesting things this past week. The awareness, thanks also to the Tax Wall Street Party intervention, the awareness of Trump as fascist is growing. Here we go. Republicans are more active, more likely to attack Trump as a fascist. Wednesday, March 23rd, Washington Post. Kathleen Parker column, Washington Post. Stand up against the Donald. And she talks about, very interesting book, you should read it, Sinclair Lewis and his book, It Can't Happen Here. Here we find the demagogy that Sinclair Lewis wrote about. It's called fascism, and it seems like it can happen here, apropos of Trump. We've also got Bruce Bartlett on MSNBC last night, dissident Republican, saying that Trump is fascistic and authoritarian. Yes. And the quicker everybody opens their eyes to this, the quicker we can get the United States out of danger. Back next week with World Crisis Radio.